The Green Room with Orla Barry on News Talk.
Think finding love is difficult today? Well, try being a woman in China who's over the age of 25, where they're not so kindly termed leftover women. Writer Roseanne Lake knows a little about it. She's lived there. She's also the author of the new book Leftover in China, The Women Shaping the World's Next Superpower. Roseanne Lake, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Orla, for having me. Delighted to be here.
Talk to us about the title. The first half of the title, first off, Leftover Women. Where and how did this term come about, do we know?
Nobody knows. It's actually a term with a rather mysterious origin. Some people think it came from a Taiwanese pop song. No one's really sure. But what is certain is it is a mainstream Chinese word. The word in Chinese, or the term in Chinese, is sheng yu, which literally means leftover woman. It's a direct translation. Sheng is the prefix for what you would say in sheng cai, or leftover food. So it really is a very unpalatable word that kind of implies that women over a certain age who aren't married are the stuff of Tupperware and doggy bags.
Wow. So I said 25. Is that fair?
25, for the most part, that's where it starts. China's changing, and of course, there are areas that are, you know, more urbanized than others. So people in more urban areas are somewhat more forgiving. But generally speaking, you know, as women inch towards 30, the flames go up and the fire department is called, and, you know, everyone around you kind of treats you like a burning building and does their best to dutifully whisk you into wedlock as quickly as possible.
So you lived there for 5 years. Well, how quickly did you become aware of this? You know, maybe you knew before you went, but was it apparent when you arrived there and started getting to know local women there?
Yeah, so I was blissfully unaware of it before I got to China, as I was of most things that happened in China, actually. But I worked with a lot of these women, but I didn't know that this is how they were referred to until after my first Chinese New Year. So I was, you know, I, like everyone else, I had time off. I went motorbiking in southern China, in Yunnan. Everyone else went home to see their parents, a lot of the Chinese women I worked with, right? So bright women who were working at a television station, they were the editors and the producers. They were, you know, bilingual. We were producing news stories for a U.S. audience. It was all news about China, an international audience, but primarily the U.S. And I came back from Chinese New Year thinking, oh, you know, everyone's come back from their hometown. It's pretty much the longest vacation they get all year long because, you know, the Chinese are not very generous with time off. So they must be well rested and, you know, happy to have been home with their families. And it was the opposite. My otherwise, you know, very charismatic colleagues were rather sullen and quiet. And I thought there were actually problems at the company, that something was going on. And I asked around, and one of the superiors, also a woman, said, no, they're just upset because they're not married. And this, of course, made absolutely no sense to me. Yeah. I, you know, as I write in the book, it's kind of like, has the Communist Party issued free honeymoons to the Maldives or something that they feel like they're going to miss out on? And so it was then that I realized that they were under a tremendous amount of pressure, and that, you know, despite everything they'd achieved, so, you know, being some of the first women in their families to have gone to college, being bilingual, supporting themselves in a much bigger city than the one they'd grown up in, all of this was eclipsed by the very simple fact that they hadn't gone home over Chinese New Year with news of a potential spouse.
Wow. So when they went home and informed them of all the work that they had achieved and the jobs they were doing, etc., it immediately moved on to the questions of a partner, potential partner. And did the parents and do the parents suggest that they engage in ways in finding a possible husband?
The parents don't suggest, they do.
Oh, they do.
You've got the blind dates lined up for you when you arrive.
Wow.
You know, sometimes you have multiple dates a day.
Wow.
No, and the, you know, they enlist the neighbors and aunties and former classmates, and they're very resourceful in using a network of people to band together for the cause.
Gosh.
Absolutely. Because, you know, when you're not married, especially in a smaller city, and you're over 25, as a woman or a man, but more so as a woman because the pressure is biological, you know, you kind of stick out like a sore thumb. This is what everyone's asking. Are you married? When are you getting married? That's the question, right? And then, of course, after you get married, it's when are you buying a home? When are you having a child? It doesn't go away, but that's when it starts.
And for them, when they went home and they faced this sudden men arriving at all hours for various dates or appointments, did they hate it? Did they welcome it? How did they feel about it?
They don't look forward to it. That is certain. But what is difficult to translate is this sense of filial piety that is still very much a big deal in China, and that these women feel towards their parents, to the extent that they're not going to say, you know, it's my holiday, leave me alone. I'm not interested in the people that you've set me up with. They're going to rather dutifully, out of respect for their parents, but also the aunties and the neighbors and the former classmates whose help has been enlisted in this endeavor. They're going to do it. I mean, they're going to play along. For the most part, you know, they don't like it. They don't like being questioned this way. Mm-hmm. I write in the book about some interesting methods, workarounds that women have for avoiding their neighbors. So, you know, arriving home at an extremely late hour of the evening so that the neighbors aren't out and unlikely to pop their heads out and start asking impertinent questions. But they do it. And that's sort of where a lot of my thinking on how romantic love works in China started to change. Because initially I thought, well, your parents are tremendous. Selfish. I mean, how could they not acknowledge everything that you've done from a professional standpoint? And just because, you know, their child is the only child not married within a however many kilometer radius, be pressuring you to do this. I mean, you'll do it on your own terms and on your own timeline if you get around to it. And if not, it's not the end of the world. Of course, their parents didn't see it this way. And so I thought the parents were very selfish. But the more I got to understand the trouble that parents went through to try to set up these partnerships and the motives for why they did it, I realized that a lot of it came out of came from love, actually. I mean, these parents realized that many of their children were only children, and, you know, they had their mortality in mind. Mm-hmm. You know, we as parents are not going to be around forever, and we'd like you to be looked after. We want someone to 照顾 you, right? To just keep an eye on you when we no longer can. We don't want you to be alone in this world. We know it's kind of difficult to face, especially in a society like China, where, you know, you don't pass into adulthood unless you've married and, you know, and have had a family. It's the building blocks of the Chinese society. You see that it comes from a place of love. It seems selfish sometimes, it seems self-serving, but when you really talk to these parents, you know, you see it differently. I did. And that was an important realization for me.
And if they were set up successfully with someone, or as successfully as I suppose as the parents hoped it to be, would they be able to continue with their job? You were working in a TV network, for example. Could they continue working in a news station?
I mean, that would truly be a successful partnership, right? Because they wouldn't have to give up too much.
Yeah.
But to give you a sense, I mean, one of my colleagues was set up with somebody who also worked in television, but he happened to work in the television factory, making television. So the person who had set up this date didn't really get the memo that she was a producer at a television network. And the man was mortified when he found out that she works on a very different spectrum of the television, right? And so in that case, you know, in many instances, and it gets complicated. So women who are from urban areas and whose parents set them up on blind dates do it kind of throughout the year because they're close to home, right? Mm. If you're born in Beijing and you live in Beijing, your mom is still there. She can set you up on blind dates in Beijing throughout the year. But if you're from a city 5 or 6 or 10, China's huge, right? If many hours away, then your parents only have a concentrated time to work on these things. And their network is going to be people in your town. So yes, the idea would be you would move back. You would give up this career. In the case of one of the main characters in the book, Zhang Mei, her parents just expected her to move, you know, leave Beijing and go back to Harbin and work in the bank where her father had been working for 30 years. You know, he had a job set up for her. And she was a Chinese teacher in Beijing. She taught foreigners Chinese. And although she didn't get to travel much and wasn't earning a fortune, it gave her the freedom to, you know, pay for her own apartment and meet tons of foreigners. She loved meeting Japanese students and Korean students and the very naughty and the very tardy Spanish students that she would always talk about. This was delightful for her. The idea of just this rubber stamp job back in Harbin, where, you know, she knew she would have to marry someone who, you know, was in the village and there wouldn't be that many people left for her to choose from, even at her age. She was 27 at the time. She's considered a dinosaur by those standards.
Wow.
You know, it's giving up a lot. And that rural-urban divide is an important distinction to keep in mind.
And mentioning the dinosaur at 27, is there a certain age that the parents just stop and they go, okay, we're throwing in the towel on this one?
I really think it depends on how many hobbies the parents have. So more and more, you know, Chinese in their 50s and 60s, they have more disposable income.
Yeah.
And that means that a lot of them are traveling. And with social media, it's becoming very popular to post photos of your travels, just like we would on Facebook. Mm. They do it on their wall in WeChat. Mm. And, you know, their platforms, like I have a friend who said, you know, it's so mysterious. My mom was on my case about getting married, and all of a sudden she just kind of stopped. And I don't think it's because she's given up, but she's joined this new karaoke platform. And she's become kind of a star on it. So every morning she wakes up and she sings, and she has people vote on her performance. What? And she gets likes. So she's kind of become swept up in this singing career, and she's left her daughter alone.
Wow.
So when women ask me for advice, like, how do I keep my parents at bay? I said, yeah, encourage hobbies.
Encourage hobbies, whatever it takes, whatever it takes.
Yes, distract them.
Yeah. Do some of the young women want to remain single, do you think? We've had conversations here on the show. There was a writer in New York was telling us how she had written this book recently about being 40 and single, and was highly featured in the New York Times at the time, but had talked about this conversation where in New York it's quite easy to be a single woman, and you can eat out and, you know, have a relatively easy existence as a single woman. In China, can you do it, and would they want to do it?
You can. I mean, you know, China's changed so quickly that it's not impossible to remain single forever. But to be completely honest, of the many, many women that I spoke to and of the four that are featured prominently in the book, I think if they had the choice, they would rather not.
Okay.
Now, that means they're not going to compromise and, you know, end up with somebody who is very far off from what they're looking for and would require them to radically change a lifestyle or give up on life goals or career goals or, you know, change dramatically. But I think the ideal for many of them is to find someone. And, you know, they're proactive about looking, but not to the extent that it derails everything else that they do. What I admire about them is that they understand, you know, that's one aspect of their lives and it's an important one that they value. But at the same time, you know, for any of that to be worth it, their own personal happiness is also very important. To be attractive to other people and you know, to be happy in the long run. So they have that understanding and many of them will remain single. I mean, just, you know, mathematically, if China adheres to this system of marriage hypergamy or this idea where, you know, a woman must marry up but a man must marry down, you have women who are, you know, achieving a lot in their own right. And they're kind of, you know, they're up there at the top of the staircase with the most elite men in the country. And the types of men that would even consider them are a smaller pool, right? Mm. So it's a competitive market. And it's remarkable. One of the main characters in the book went to Yale, and I was doing an event with the Yale Club in Beijing. So many graduates of Yale who were back in China and working, and the women were grilling me on how, you know, on ideas for how they should be dating. They wanted to be proactive, but they wanted to know what the market looked like. I mean, these were women, I don't know, many of them had gone on to business school. They wanted to know, like, do I need to be serious about this at 25, or can I get an MA or an MBA or a PhD, or is that going to work against me, right? Is it okay to be 30 with a PhD? Are you still marriageable? Or sorry, 30 with a master's, are you still more marriageable? Are you still marriageable, or are you more marriageable at 27 with a PhD? Mm-hmm. They wanted to know the relationship between education and age and how that worked against them in the market. And they were just very focused on, you know, well, this is the reality of the market that we face, and we're going to do our best to sort of work within it without compromising too much. They were being very pragmatic about it, which I think is almost required in the market. There.
Yeah, sure. Some women might say maybe that we should think about that in other parts of the world as well. As regards, I mentioned the parents, you know, taking on this role of matchmaker. Things in the rest of, you know, a lot of other countries, dating apps are very central to the dating scene. Is that the case in China?
Very good question. Well, there are apps like Tantan that you could say are something like Tinder, right? You swipe and it's there could be hookups involved. It's not a marriage-minded app or a serious dating-minded app, but there are other ones that are. I mean, apps that exist for the sole purpose of finding you a marriage partner. And on these apps, it's not uncommon for parents to create accounts on behalf of their children and chat up potential suitors on their behalf. You know, so you have moms who go on and
these parents know no bounds. Yeah,
they don't. And, you know, it's just a way of, remember how I said earlier, like parents in faraway cities that are, you know, far away from their children, their networks don't extend as far. Well, with online dating, they do. It's a way of recreating that network. And Rose Guang, the founder of Shiji Jiayuan, one of these big platforms, said it to me that way. I mean, she said, you know, with all of this rural to urban migration, I just wanted to find a way to replace those social support networks that, you know, we traditionally had in the search for a marriage partner. And so, yeah, it's not uncommon for moms to go in and, you know, chat up prospective suitors and tell their daughters, well, 4 p.m. on Sunday, please be here for a tea with this gentleman. You know, he has this job, he has, he earns this much money, is this blood type, you know, whatever it is.
Yeah.
They collect that information.
and actually, the full title of the book, I asked you about the leftover bit. So Leftover in China, The Women Shaping the World's Next Superpower. The other side of the coin then, because they're being very successful in their career, as regards reaching the top of the business world and the glass ceiling and all of that, are they getting to the top of companies? Are there many Chinese CEOs? What's that world
it's
like?
It's getting there. I mean, it's a very tricky question. I mean, on the one hand, China is many, it's almost like two different countries, right? It's a very developed country on the one hand. It's a cashless society. FinTech is light years ahead of where it is in other places, but it's also still a very poor country, right? It's easy to forget that when we see things like Crazy Rich Asians, which is all the rage.
Yeah.
It's, you know, it takes place in Singapore, but I think we have this idea that there's a lot of money in Asia, and of course there is, but there's also still a lot of poverty, right? So there are parts of China where that's not as true, but in urban areas where, you know, most of the women that I feature happen to be born, because in rural areas, not many girls were born to begin with, right? Under the one-child policy, parents in rural areas didn't want girls. You do start to see more of that happening. I mean, women they're well-educated. They are now, you know, as of a couple of years ago, they're earning more college degrees than men. And naturally, that's translating into, you know, greater bargaining power in the professional world. And of course, there's still, you know, people who are sensitive to higher a woman, right? They may be worried about, oh, she's going to take off time when she starts to have a child, or now children, since that's possible. There's a pay gap, absolutely. You know, there are, you know, these problems that exist the world over exist in China as well. But because so much of China's future economy rides on women, so much of this consumer economy, this e-commerce economy that China is now transitioning into, right? It's no longer the manufacturing capital of the world, making cheap goods in huge quantities and shipping them out everywhere. It's too expensive to do that in China. That's moving on to places like Thailand or Vietnam. China's moving into a knowledge and service-based economy. And these women, because they grew up in urban areas and because they're very well-educated, are natural candidates to be able to take a leading role in all of that. And, you know, as this economic model shifts from a government giving out huge loans to state-owned enterprises to build airports and shopping malls and bridges that on paper represent economic growth, that's now transitioning to a more, you know, an economy driven by domestic spending. We know women are very good consumers, right? And so that's the market that people are going after. And also, you know, from a population perspective, China didn't say the one-child policy, you can now have two, because it wanted to give more reproductive rights to women. It's an aging population.
Yeah.
And it needs more babies. And who else is, I mean, until you can make a child, you know, I don't know, in a washing machine, it's going to have to be a woman who does it. And so I think the government is aware that finding a way, or I hope you're aware, that finding a way to make it possible for these women to achieve what they're already very well set up to achieve, given the odd circumstances of their birth and this one-child policy and you know, this perfect storm of China becoming very wealthy in their short lifespan, they're going to be at a very important part of it going forward from an economic perspective, but also a demographic perspective.
Did they mind, by the way, those women featured in your book being featured?
They didn't. You know, one of them, June, she said, no, you know, quote me liberally, I hope this is for the good of Chinese womankind.
Wow. Well, to hear more about their lives, the book is entitled Leftover in China, The Women Shaping the World's Next Superpower. Its author is Roseanne Lake. Roseanne, great to talk to you. Thanks so much for joining us here on the show.
Thank you. My pleasure.
News Talk 106 to 108.